The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Monday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. Today we're going to talk with Jean Holthouse. She's the author of Managing Worry and Anxiety, Practical Tools to Help You Deal with Life's Challenges. She'll join us in the 5 o'clock hour. James Blind is producing today's program, Clark Hilton Engineering. By the way, portions of today's program are brought to you by Liberty Coin and Currency. Liberty with a T rather than a D. Taking a look at some of the day's headlines, presidential contender Joe Biden jokingly called a college student in New Hampshire a lying dog-faced pony soldier during a campaign event on Sunday. Apparently, that's a reference to an old movie. Just 2 months after he unloaded on an Iowa voter whom he called a prevaricator, I'll put it a more polite way, and days after he dryly instructed a climate activist to go vote for someone else. Well, the student, Madison Moore, of Mercer University in Georgia, began by asking Biden how he could remain competitive in the race after that performance. It's a good question, Biden responded. Number one, Iowa's Democratic caucus. You ever been to a caucus? No, you haven't. And then he called her the name. You said you were, but now you've got to be honest. I'm going to be honest with you. It was a little bit confusing in Iowa. Well, Biden, now 77, which has become an issue, the only reason I mention it, has gone on the offensive following his disappointing fourth place finish in last week's disastrous Iowa caucuses, well behind rivals Pete Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren. His defensiveness on the campaign trail has raised questions about his possible electability issues, especially given President Trump's propensity for hammering the Biden's perceived corruption. This past December in Iowa, Biden slammed a voter who questioned Hunter Biden's business dealings as a prevaricator, in more colorful language, who needed to take an IQ test. That was just another of several questionable comments made to voters on the campaign trail. Now, this is only questionable because it's filled with vitriol, and that's uncharacteristic. We certainly see that coming from President Trump on a regular basis. Japan may test every person aboard the Diamond Princess for the coronavirus after it was determined on Monday that there are 60 new cases on the quarantined trip, a ship rather, docked off the coast of Yokohama. In addition, China's health ministry said another 3,062 cases have been reported over the previous 24 hours, raising the Chinese mainland's total of 40,171. The number of deaths grew by 97 to 908. Well, the South Korean film Parasite made history at the 92nd Academy Awards Sunday by becoming the first non-English language movie to win for Best Picture. Parasite took Hollywood's top prize on Sunday night, along with awards for Best Director, Best International Film, and Best Screenplay. Meanwhile, after winning the Best Supporting Actor award for his role in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Brad Pitt took a shot at Republican senators who voted against calling witnesses at President Trump's impeachment trial. This was the lowest viewed Oscars program in Oscar history. Impeachment witness Alexander Vindman, who's suspected of releasing classified information, is fired and escorted out of the White House after the president's acquittal. And the president has recalled Ambassador Gordon Sondland as well. Both played significant roles as impeachment witnesses. The president's budget would cut $4.4 trillion in spending, boost defense spending while slashing safety nets and foreign aid, according to news sources. And Iowa Democrat Party awards Pete Buttigieg 14 delegates, Bernie Sanders 12 after the caucus meltdown in Iowa. Buttigieg has argued for an end to the Electoral College after the Iowa victory without popular vote. And Buttigieg's high school essay praised a profile in courage, Bernie Sanders, which was rather useful on the campaign trail. Actor Gary Sinise is recognized with the Congressional Medal of Honor Society's Patriot Award for supporting veterans. And the Obama-produced film has won an Oscar. Producer quotes the Communist Manifesto in her acceptance speech. Two New York officers have been shot in assassination attempts. The president rips Mayor Bill de Blasio, and the law enforcement there have arisen against him as well. One man had deliberately rammed his vehicle into a GOP tent full of volunteers, according to the Daily Wire. By all accounts, no one was seriously hurt. On this day in history, 1936, Nazi Germany's Reichstag passes a law investing the Gestapo, secret police, with absolute authority, exempt from any legal review. On this day in history, 1967, the 25th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution dealing with presidential disability and succession is ratified in Minnesota and Nevada. Adopted. In 1968, U.S. figure skater Peggy Fleming, 19, wins America's only gold medal of the Winter Olympic Games in Grenoble, France, in the ladies' singles event. And on this day in history, 2004, John Kerry wins the Virginia and Tennessee Democratic primaries. 2009, the Senate approves President Barack Obama's giant economic stimulus measure. And also in 2009, on this very day, U.S. and Russian communication satellites collide in the first ever crash of its kind in orbit, shooting out a pair of massive debris clouds. Well, according to the state Democratic Party, Pete Buttigieg got 14 delegates, while Sanders 12, even though Sanders had considerably more votes. Hugh Hewitt points out that those are the rules. Like the Electoral College, candidates are looking for delegates. The mayor got 14, Bernie Sanders 12. Like total yards versus score in football games, the stats don't count, winners do. It's Pete B's for the win. Byron York wrote, talk about phony precision. Iowa Democratic Party calculates points to the 1/1,000th, but won't correct caucus officials' errors. So Buttigieg wins. Sanders follows closely behind. Nina Turner says, who's the national chairwoman for Sanders' campaign, I feel bad for the people of Iowa who take great pride in the caucus process. They were robbed. Our campaign and all the thousands of volunteers that combed that entire state on behalf of this campaign, it was really wrong. Again, calling into question the outcome now made official of the Iowa caucus. Well, documentary filmmaker Julia Reichert said, our film is from Ohio and China, but it really could be from anywhere that people put on a uniform, punch a clock, trying to make a better life. We believe things will be better when workers of the world unite. That raised some eyebrows. Joaquin Phoenix gave an absolutely bizarre and self-righteous acceptance speech that had nothing to do with acting or and included an anti-milk statement, while Brad Pitt, in his Best Supporting Actor acceptance speech, said, they told me I only had 45 seconds up here, which is 45 seconds more than the Senate gave John Bolton this week. Larry Elder says of Brad Pitt, the winner of the Best Supporting Actor Award, that he made a crack about John Bolton not testifying before the Senate during the Trump impeachment trial. Apparently, Pitt was unaware that Bolton has refused to testify without a subpoena. And a man has driven into a tent of registered Trump voters, apparently in an attempt to kill Trump supporters. In another story, a gunman attempted to assassinate New York City policemen. He was caught the second time when he walked right into a precinct and began firing. From the New York City Scanner tweet, the gunman walked up to the marked NYPD van, asked for directions, then opened fire. The officer in the driver's seat was shot in the chin, but is expected to survive. And at over 900 death tolls, now well beyond SARS, over 40,000 infections in China and the first U.S. death from the coronavirus. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
20 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Well, as mentioned, Iowa Democratic Party has awarded Pete Buttigieg 14 delegates. Bernie Sanders, 12, after the caucus meltdown. Sanders maintained his significant lead in the popular vote in both rounds of the caucusing. However, he fell behind in the delegate count because some precincts are weighted differently by the Iowa Democrats in the complex and little understood and apparently poorly implemented formula. Well, as the meltdown continued to unfold on Sunday, Jonah Herman announced that he would resign as head of the media for the Iowa Democratic Party. He suggested that people should not question whether the Democratic National Committee was again rigging the primary race against Sanders, as speculation would feed into the narrative that will result in Trump's reelection. But it remained unclear whether those results would stand unmodified. The Democratic National Committee head, Tom Perez, who's also been called upon to step down last week, said a re-canvass like the one being requested by the Sanders team was needed to assure public confidence. Enough is enough, he wrote on Twitter. Well, a condemning analysis by the New York Times last week found that the Iowa Democratic Party figures were full of apparent errors in which the vote numbers from several precincts didn't match totals provided by the party, and in which numerous precincts seemingly didn't follow caucus rules. In one especially bizarre apparent mistake, the party reported that Deval Patrick had dominated in central Iowa, apparently because Sanders votes had been incorrectly recorded as votes for Patrick. Well, the Times reported that a plausible explanation for that mistake is that an Iowa Democratic Party staff member accidentally copied the results of one column too far to the left in a spreadsheet for some precincts. Such errors inevitably occur in manual data entry, but the Iowa Democratic Party does not appear to have enough quality checks to assure that its reports are accurate. The Associated Press announced on Thursday of last week it was simply unable to declare a winner of the Democrats' Iowa caucuses. They called the race when there is a clear indication of a winner because of a tight margin between former Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Senator Bernie Sanders and the irregularities in this year's caucus process. They said it's not possible to determine a winner at this point. An AP's senior vice president and executive director wrote, well, last week, both Buttigieg and Sanders declared victory in Iowa. And depending on which markers they pointed to, they were right, appeared ready to move on. They're now in New Hampshire. We've got enough of Iowa. Sanders told CNN at a town hall last week, suggesting he wouldn't bother with a re-canvass, even though the Iowa Democrats obviously had screwed up in a historic manner. Well, former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who claimed victory in that contest and controversial Iowa caucus, has had a target on his back of late, and he fired back after taking shots from rivals former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders. Biden, who recently released an ad that appeared to mock Buttigieg's political experience, had said of the ex-mayor, he's no Barack Obama. Buttigieg threw it right back. Well, he's right, and neither is he. Buttigieg says in a lengthy interview on Fox Sunday, neither is any of us, and this isn't 2008, it's 2020. Ouch. Well, Buttigieg later continued his war of words with Sanders, who took a shot at Buttigieg over his financial backing during Friday night's Democratic debate. Unlike some of the folks up here, don't have 40 billionaires. Pete, contributing to my campaign, coming from the pharmaceutical industry, Wall Street, and all the big money interests, Sanders said. Well, Buttigieg responded Sunday by looking at his ultimate goal, winning the general election. We're building the movement that is going to defeat Donald Trump, he said. I want everybody to help out. Well, the former mayor said it doesn't matter to him how wealthy a supporter is if they're willing to help his campaign and be a part of his mission. Buttigieg said this campaign has received 2 million contributions, with the average being under $40. Buttigieg said, rather than dividing the Democratic base, he is looking to unite people behind him. I'm building a campaign that's not defined by who we reject. It's defined by belonging. It's defined by inclusion. It's defined by pulling together the coalition to get the job done. He also added an issue that came up on Friday's debate regarding statistics related to black people being more likely than whites to be arrested for marijuana. That disparity is there, and it's there in our cities and across the country, he said, while saying that the big picture is that in my city, black residents were less likely to be arrested on drug charges than in the state or in the country. Still, he said the disparity is real. Looking at general elections, Buttigieg said he supports the elimination of the Electoral College. He doubted that doing so would result in states such as Iowa and New Hampshire being overlooked in favor of large population centers in coastal cities, which was the concern of the founders. We don't run governor's races with some Electoral College system where certain counties count more than certain other counties, which, of course, is a misreading of the point. Meanwhile, a new national Quinnipiac poll shows Bernie Sanders jumping out to his biggest lead in any national poll of the Democratic primary. Sanders at 25%, and this is a general poll, I should say. And the Quinnipiac poll says nearly half of Biden's African-American supporters have abandoned him. He is absolutely dependent on African-American supporters supporting him if he's going to succeed. Again, the poll, Sanders at 25%, Biden at 17%, Bloomberg at 15%, Warren 15%, Buttigieg 10%, Klobuchar at 4%. Just before the Iowa caucuses, the top line numbers in Quinnipiac's late January national poll were Biden at 26%, he's now at 17%, Sanders at 21%, He's at 25, Warren at 15, still at 15 in this latest poll, Bloomberg at 8, at 15 in the current poll, Klobuchar at 7, she's down 4, and Buttigieg at 6 in the earlier poll, now at 10. Biden has been counting on South Carolina as his firewall, where two-thirds of the Democratic Party primary voters are African-American, but the new National Quinnipiac poll shows that support for him among African-Americans dropped from 52% to 27% since the Iowa caucuses. Well, the winner of the 2020 presidential election is almost certainly in New Hampshire, and the crowds candidates are drawing at events around the state offer some clues as to who has the momentum for Tuesday's high-stakes primary and beyond. Of course, that's the New Hampshire primary tomorrow. While President Trump is expected to pull in his usual capacity crowd at a night rally in Manchester tonight, the Democrats seeking his job are crisscrossing the Granite State to appear at town halls, auditoriums, diners, and a pretty frenetic push to win over voters in the nation's critical first primary in New Hampshire. Trump, the outcome of the Republican primary in New Hampshire is almost certainly going to be Trump winning, but the president is taking advantage of the heightened attention on that state as he flies into its most populous city for a rally tonight. Senator Warren has a get-out-the-vote event planned for Rochester Opera House, which can fit about 900 people. She's also going to be at the town hall in Portsmouth South Church, which a year ago squeezed in about 1,000 people in an effort to gain their support. By the way, that was for Kamala Harris' campaign, according to her former press secretary. But before her afternoon and evening activities, Warren spent the morning trudging through the snow at a 2.2-mile walk, which included a stop for some McDonald's breakfast. Senator Sanders will appear at 4 New Hampshire events by the time Monday is over, including a breakfast in Manchester, a town hall at Franklin Pierce University, a canvassing event in Hudson, and a rally at Whitmore Center Arena in Durham, which can fit about 7,500 of Sanders' adoring supporters. The self-proclaimed Democratic Socialist will entertain his rally-goers with a performance from The Strokes and an appearance with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Also in the category of celebrity, Sanders' surrogate Cynthia Nixon, an actress and former Democratic primary challenger to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Pete Buttigieg, the surging former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, had a meet and greet in Plymouth State University this morning ahead of two rallies later in the day at Hampshire Hills Athletic Club in Milford, another at Exeter High School at 8 p.m. Local time. He's hoping to draw a raucous crowd to compete with Trump at his evening events, particularly as his campaign continues to ride a wave of self-declared Iowa victory. Senator Amy Klobuchar, who is enjoying a bit of a surge after an impressive debate performance on Friday night, is packing four events into her Monday schedule. She held a Get Out the Vote event in Keene before a noon event in Nashua County Club. She also has an afternoon event at Exeter Town Hall and an event at the American Legion in Rochester, which says on the website it can hold 600 people. Former Vice President Joe Biden is looking to stop the bleeding in New Hampshire after a gut punch in Iowa, and he might be able to pick up some momentum Monday thanks to an endorsement from the New Hampshire Senate President Donna Soce. He'll likely tout Soce's support at his Monday events. The former vice president's itinerary includes a Get Out the Vote event in Guilford Community Church, which can hold about 400, and an evening event at St. George Greek Orthodox Cathedral. Earlier on Monday, he also doled out some breakfast patties at a school bus to school bus drivers and one kid in Nashua. Tulsi Gabbard has spent more time in New Hampshire than any other candidate, but has struggled to register at anything above mid-single digits in the polls. She held a town hall meeting at the Rex Theater in Manchester. That venue seats about 300. And Andrew Yang, the businessman still reeling from a dismal finish in Iowa, will be the busiest candidate in the field on Monday in what might be the last gasp for his unconventional campaign. He's holding six events today. His stops include a town hall in Rochester, Concord, Portsmouth, Manchester, Derry, and Keene. His 8 p.m. stop in Tupelo Music Hall in Derry could draw up to 700 people, according to the capacity on the Music Hall's website. Busy day for the Democrats. There's also some discussion about the possibility of a brokered convention. We'll tell you more about that when we return. Also, a reminder, we'll talk with Jean Hofhaus. She's the author of Managing Worry and Anxiety, Practical Tools to Help You Deal with Life's Challenges. In the second hour of today's program, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show. Later this next hour, we'll talk with Jean Holthaus. She's the author of Managing Worry and Anxiety, Practical Tools to Help You Deal with Life's Challenges. The book is published by Revell, and she'll join us about a quarter past the hour in the 5 o'clock hour. Well, the chance of a contested Democratic convention has increased after the muddle of the Iowa caucuses, raising anxieties ahead of tomorrow's New Hampshire primary, which is a different animal. Iowa's delayed results left five top-tier candidates soldiering on, even as New York City Mayor Pete Buttigieg blankets television airwaves with advertisements ahead of his first appearance on ballots in March. This has all raised the likelihood of a longer primary fight where none of the candidates might win the 1,900 delegates needed to clinch the party's presidential nomination. How likely is that? I don't know, but there certainly is a lot more discussion about a brokered convention. It's possible. It's quite possible. That's what the former New Hampshire Democratic Party chairman and veteran political operative in the state is saying. I think Bloomberg entering into the thing provides a much greater possibility of a brokered convention. Now, a brokered convention, which would increase the power of the party officials known as superdelegates, would be good news for President Trump, since those who lose such a contest might be even more angered over the process. It would be much better if we had a candidate win a sufficient number of delegates going into the convention, Mr. Spiro went on to say, but I'm confident we'll have a candidate coming out of it who can defeat Donald Trump. Well, Iowa appears to have ended with a near tie between former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Buttigieg and Senator Bernie Sanders. The two of them and three others, former Vice President Joe Biden, Senators Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar, all have reasons to continue on after Iowa. The field still consists of 11 candidates in all, including two billionaires in Bloomberg and Tom Steyer. The latest forecast model from the 538 put the chances of no candidate winning a majority of delegates at 24%. No candidate reached the 30% mark in Iowa or dropped out after the caucuses, which have traditionally winnowed the field. Not this time. The centrist vote is deeply divided at the moment between Buttigieg, Biden, and Klobuchar, who's getting a burst of momentum heading into Election Day after raising $2 million in the hours after the New Hampshire debate. She did pretty well. Sanders appears to have galvanized the left, but Warren has a lot of money, a top-notch organization, and an energized base of supporters eager to see the first woman elected to the White House. Steyer, he found little support in Iowa, but is running strong in South Carolina, and businessman Andrew Yang and Representative Tulsi Gabbard have their own pockets of support in New Hampshire. Now, some Democrats hope that New Hampshire will give more clarity to the race, but there's no guarantee. There's a real possibility of a brokered convention, and that is in itself maybe enough to serve as motivation for some who might have otherwise dropped out to hang around longer to see if they can't have a place in this thing and play a part in determining the nominee. Well, no one has ever, no one has more resources than Bloomberg, who has spent more than $300 million on television ads already and announced the day after the Iowa caucuses that he'd double that amount in the weeks ahead. A clear sign that he sees a path to scooping up delegates in the chaotic and rather fluid race. Well, his ad blitz has been effective, boosting him into double digits in national polls. He's the only candidate running a true national campaign with staff, offices, and resources spread across all of the Super Tuesday states and beyond. He can afford it. He can be in all 14 Super Tuesday states at the same time through TV and social media. A Democratic National Committee member says no other candidate has that ability. He also has been aggressive in courting governors, mayors, and House members, scooping up unexpected endorsements, meeting behind the scenes with state parties and local advocacy groups. And those actions are a sign that Bloomberg is angling for the kind of support he's going to need from party leaders to win a potential contested convention. Well, Bloomberg potentially could spend $4 billion to $5 billion of his own money, not just for his own campaign, but for Democrats all over, from dog catcher to Senate. Lenny Glenn, a Massachusetts businessman who crossed into New Hampshire to hear from the candidates. Every single superdelegate at the Democratic convention, if we don't have a clear majority, is going to realize Mike Bloomberg might spend $5 million in support of my campaign for a district in Oklahoma. So, yeah, there's a chance. Well, Bloomberg rivals have taken notice, hammering him at the debate on Friday and saying it's unacceptable for a billionaire to step in and try to buy the nomination. Only 41 delegates were divided up in Iowa, and it's possible the field will narrow quickly this month after Super Tuesday. There are huge numbers of undecided voters whose biggest concern is electability, and they could flock to the candidate who starts winning states once more voters have had their say. Well, while several campaigns appear viable at the moment, several could be running on fumes by this year's Super Tuesday, which, by the way, is March the 3rd. Candidates with small delegate hauls will be under pressure to drop out. Party leaders who have stayed on the sidelines, like President Obama, might step up to get behind a consensus pick in an effort to bring the candidate home. It's always possible, but it's too early to tell at this point. Well, still, Democrats say all the ingredients are there to make it a possibility. Every 4 years, there's a fantasy about the possibility and how fun and exciting it would be. Yeah, that's from a veteran campaign hand from several presidential and congressional races, and certainly not a candidate. This year, you have the Iowa muddle, Bloomberg's billions, Biden's strength with African Americans, which is waning. So it could happen. And if it doesn't happen with all that's going on at this time, it probably never will. Well, we'll see what does, in fact, take place. Tomorrow are the is the New Hampshire primary, and that may or may not winnow the field down just a bit. Meanwhile, in other news, U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, who testified about President Trump's Ukraine dealings during the House impeachment hearing, said on Friday he'd been recalled from his overseas position hours after the National Security Council aide who testified against the president was also fired. I was advised today that the president intends to recall me effective immediately as United States ambassador to the European Union, Sondland said. He said, his recall follows the dismissal of another impeachment witness, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who was fired from the National Security Council and escorted off the White House grounds on Friday. Now, fired means he's not in that job. He's not in the NSA, but he's back to the Defense Department or the Pentagon. The moves come just 2 days after the president was acquitted in the Senate on two articles of impeachment brought by the House. With Sondland and Vindman out, 8 of 12 officials who testified publicly during the impeachment hearings have left their roles, been fired, or reassigned. I'm grateful to President Trump for having given me the opportunity to serve, to Secretary Pompeo for his consistent support, and to the exceptional and dedicated professionals at the U.S. mission to the European Union, Sondland said on Friday. I am proud of our accomplishments. Our work here has been the highlight of my career, end quote. In November, Sondland tied top officials to a potential quid pro quo involving U.S. military aid to Ukraine and investigations desired by Trump during his highly anticipated impeachment hearing testimony. The impeachment inquiry was sparked by a whistleblower complaint, as you well know. Well, Democrats expressed outrage over the dismissals. Those who suggested President Trump's behavior would improve following his impeachment have been proven wrong. New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez said he's the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I sincerely hope that all members of Congress condemn this latest reprehensible yet sadly predictable conduct by President Trump. Now, the president does have the freedom to hire and fire at will. This in such close proximity to testimony is what Mr. Menendez is referring to. Vindman was on detail of the National Security Council from the Department of Defense and is expected he will return there. Vindman's attorney, David Pressman, confirmed that he had been escorted out of the White House on Friday. There's no question in my mind and the mind of any American why this man's job is over. The president, when asked about Vindman on Friday, told reporters that he was not happy with him. And that seems to be an understatement. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. 46 minutes after 4 o'clock is the time. We'll be back in just a few moments.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
50 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. In the second hour of today's program, about a quarter after the hour, Jean Holthaus will be my guest. She's the author of Managing Worry and Anxiety, Practical Tools to Help You Deal with Your Life's Challenges. That's coming up about 20 or 19 after the hour. Well, the White House on Sunday unveiled a $4.8 trillion budget proposal that would slash spending dramatically on foreign aid and social safety nets, while including $2 billion for a southern border wall and substantially boosting funding to NASA, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and the Department of Homeland Security. It's been confirmed that the by the Wall Street Journal that the package set to be formally announced is stood little chance of passage in the House, which the Democrats have controlled. Still, it served as a signal of the president's priorities as Republicans have aimed to retake the chamber in the 2020 election. By the way, there's an election coming up. The president right now is at a rally in New Hampshire, in Manchester, the largest city, in an effort to deflect attention from others who are anticipating the New Hampshire primary for the Democrats. Anyway, the plan aims to eliminate the federal deficit, or the difference between spending and revenue that's slated to exceed $1 trillion this year by 2035. In all, the White House is seeking to cut $4.4 trillion in federal spending over the next 10 years, including reductions in spending on food stamps, federal disability benefits through more stringent work and eligibility requirements, total cuts to non-defense discretionary programs, which do not include Medicare or Social Security, amount to $2 trillion in savings under his plan. The budget additionally calls for renewing the Trump administration's tax cuts for individuals and families that would otherwise expire in 2025. Modifications in Medicare prescription drug pricing would account for $130 billion in savings. Working together, the president said during last week's State of the Union address, the Congress can reduce drug prices substantially from current levels. I have been speaking to Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa and others in Congress in order to get something on drug pricing done and done properly. I'm calling for bipartisan legislation that achieves the goal of dramatically lowering prescription drug prices. Get a bill to my desk and I will sign it into law without delay. Well, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi bashed the plan on Sunday. The budget is a statement of values, and once again, the president is showing just how little he values the good health, financial security, and well-being of hardworking American families, end quote. Foreign aid would be reduced by 21%, in keeping with the president's push to have other countries pay what he calls their fair share for their own defense. His temporary suspension of aid to Ukraine helped trigger impeachment proceedings. One of Republicans' defenses was that the president has long sought to suspend or reduce U.S. financial commitments overseas, especially to notoriously corrupt countries. The Environmental Protection Agency would face a massive 26% reduction in funding. The Trump administration has rolled back Obama-era EPA regulations and oversight, saying they have hurt the economy for little benefit. The proposal also would cut the Department of Housing and Urban Development budget by 15% while incorporating $2.8 billion for grants to help combat homelessness. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention would see a 9% cut, although its $4.3 billion allocation for fighting infectious disease would remain amid the coronavirus spread. Homeland Security's budget would grow by 3%, the National Nuclear Security Administration by 19%, and the Department of Veterans Affairs by 13%. Again, grow. Fiscal year 2021 budget further aims to increase military spending by 0.3%. It doubles spending on artificial intelligence from $973 million to $2 billion by 2022, including a focus on quantum computing. It's been reported this weekend on the budget's 12% hike in NASA funding with a goal of returning astronauts to the moon. No one has been to the moon since 1972 under NASA's now shuttered Apollo program. Since taking office, the president has made space exploration one of his top priorities, and his administration is set to set a target of 2024 for the next lunar landing. NASA's new space program, named Artemis, for the Greek goddess of the moon and sisters to Apollo, has aimed to put the first woman on the moon. Long-term, NASA has wanted to establish a sustainable human presence on the moon with the goal of sending humans to Mars by the 2030s. Trump's budget specifically would increase NASA spending from about $22.6 billion to $25.2 billion in fiscal year 2021, one of the biggest spending increases requested since the 90s. $3 billion will go toward new funding to develop human landers. The big lunar budget request was in addition to the president's other astronomical projects. The Space Force, the president signed an Oval Office directive last February to make the Space Force the sixth branch of the military with a mission to patrol the orbit and protect the U.S. from attacks. Just weeks ago, for the first time since the president established the Air Force more than 70 years earlier, we created a brand new branch of the U.S. Armed Forces, he said in the State of the Union. It's called the Space Force. More on that in the days ahead. Meanwhile, charging that so-called sanctuary cities that protect illegal immigrants are jeopardizing domestic security, Attorney General Bill Barr announced a slew of additional sanctions that he called a significant escalation against left-wing local and state governments that obstruct the lawful functioning of our nation's immigration system. Speaking at the National Sheriff's Association 2020 Winter Legislative and Technology Conference in Washington, Barr said the Justice Department would immediately file multiple lawsuits against sanctuary jurisdictions and implement new national reviews of left-wing sanctuary governments and prosecutors. The department is filing a complaint against the state of New Jersey seeking declaratory and injunctive relief against its laws that forbid state and local law enforcement from sharing vital information about criminal aliens to the Department of Homeland Security. He said this during this conference. It was a reference to New Jersey Attorney General Law Enforcement Directive 2018-6, which the department says illegally bars officials from sharing the immigration status and release dates of individuals in custody. It also requires New Jersey law enforcement to promptly notify a detained individual in writing and in a language the individual can understand if Immigration and Customs Enforcement files an immigration detainer request for the individual. We are filing a complaint seeking declaratory and injunctive relief against King County, Washington, for the policy that forbids DHS from deporting aliens from the United States using King County International Airport. The lawsuit targets King County Executive Order PFC 7-1EO, which the Department of Justice said was dramatically increasing the operating costs of ICE for detainees have had to be transported to Yakima, Washington. The executive order unconstitutionally conflicts with the Federal Airline Deregulation Act, which prohibits localities such as the King County from enacting or enforcing laws or regulations that relate to prices, routes, or services of air carriers, according to the Department of Justice. Further, we are reviewing the practices, policies, and laws of other jurisdictions across the country. This includes assessing whether jurisdictions are complying with our criminal laws, in particular, the criminal statute that prohibits the harboring or shielding of aliens in the United States, Barr added, noting that the Department of Justice would support DHS with federal subpoenas to access information about criminal aliens in the custody of uncooperative jurisdictions. Barr went on to say, we are meticulously reviewing the actions of certain district attorneys who have adopted policies of charging foreign nationals with lesser offenses for the express purpose of avoiding the federal immigration consequences of those nationals' criminal conduct. In pursuing their personal ambitions and misguided notions of equal justice, these district attorneys are systematically violating the rule of law and may even be unlawfully discriminating against American citizens. Well, prosecutors in New York and California have changed their policy so the prosecutors consider so-called collateral consequences, including deportation, before pursuing certain charges. Sanctuary cities, Barr said, are defined as those whose policies that allow criminal aliens to escape federal law enforcement, and some jurisdictions are becoming more aggressive in undermining immigration authorities, with some local politicians develop schemes to circumvent immigration officials altogether. The express purpose of these policies is to shelter aliens whom local law enforcement have already arrested for crimes, Barr said, noting that the Constitution empowers the federal government to enforce immigration laws, even as it entrusted the police power to the states. This is neither lawful nor sensible. In November, ICE filed a detainer for an alien who was arrested for assaulting his own father. The local police in New York City said that they had an alien in custody, but they ignored the detainer. So the alien was released onto the streets. And last month, he allegedly raped and killed a 92-year-old Maria Fuentes, affectionately known as Albulita, a fixture of her Queens neighborhood. Additionally, in October of 2017, DHS identified a convicted criminal alien with four prior removals at a city jail in Washington state. Barr said that the DHS filed a retainer. Subsequently, he fought with a jail staff and was taken to a local medical center for treatment. But after receiving treatment, they released the alien in violation of the detainer, and he was arrested and booked for murdering and dismembering his cousin. These announcements being made by the Attorney General earlier today. We've got news and traffic coming at the top of the hour. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the second hour of The Georgine Rice Show. Glad to have you with us this afternoon. We're going to be talking with Jean Holthaus. She is the author of Managing Worry and Anxiety, Practical Tools to Help You Deal with Life's Challenges. And life is certainly full of them. We'll be talking with her about that in our next segment. So looking forward to that conversation. We're winding our way through some of the top news stories. Of course, New Hampshire is where everyone's attention is focused as the New Hampshire primary is about to take place tomorrow. The president has a rally going on there right now, and the candidates, at least the top-tier candidates, are fanned out all over the state to try to influence the outcome of tomorrow's primary. So we'll certainly follow that tomorrow. Meanwhile, a federal judge today indefinitely postponed the sentencing date for President Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, on charges of lying to the FBI in the Russia investigation. The move by Judge Emmett Sullivan comes a day after federal prosecutors filed a rare Sunday motion to delay a number of approaching deadlines that would ultimately make Flynn's February 27th sentencing unlikely. Well, that delay also comes weeks after Flynn withdrew his guilty plea. Well, in their filing, prosecutors argue that Flynn's former attorneys should testify after he claimed to have received ineffective assistance from them. Flynn had previously hired the premier D.C. law firm Covington & Burling. Federal lawyers also asked the judge to order that Flynn has his attorney-client privilege in his communications with Covington & Burling waived. Well, the government requests that the court suspend the current briefing schedule concerning the defendant's motion until such time as the government has been able to confer with Covington regarding the information it seeks, prosecutors wrote. While Covington has indicated a willingness to comply with the request, it has understandably declined to do so in the absence of a court order confirming the waiver of attorney-client privilege. Well, Flynn in January moved to withdraw his guilty plea for lying to the FBI in the Russia probe, citing bad faith by the government. That court filing came just days after the Justice Department reversed course on recommending up to 6 months of prison time in his case, alleging he was not fully cooperating or accepting responsibility for his actions. Well, the prosecution has shown abject bad faith and pure retaliation against Mr. Flynn since he retained new counsel, Flynn's attorneys wrote in the filing. This can only be because with new unconflicted counsel, Mr. Flynn refused to lie for the prosecution. Well, Flynn's case, it stemmed from a 2017 FBI interview, this has gone on for some time, in which he was asked about his conversations with former Russian ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Kislyak. Well, Flynn ultimately pled guilty to making false statements regarding those conversations during his interview as part of former special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Well, Judge Sullivan in December rejected claims from Flynn's lawyers that he was pressured to plead guilty for lying to federal investigators about his contacts with the Russian diplomat. But a federal judge today indefinitely postponed the sentencing date for the president's former national security advisor. And it continues. Well, deaths from the novel coronavirus have now surpassed that of SARS in the early 2000s, with more than 800 dead so far, according to multiple reports. Hubei province in China reported 81 deaths on Saturday, which pushed the death toll for the virus to 811, past that of the severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, which broke out on the mainland in 2002 and 2003. Well, that outbreak killed at least 774 people, with 8,096 infections globally, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The coronavirus, by comparison, has already infected at least 37,000 and has taken the lives of at least 811 people on China's mainland as of Saturday night. The first death outside of China was recorded in the Philippines on Sunday. The 44-year-old Chinese man from Wuhan was hospitalized last week with a fever, cough, and sore throat and died after developing severe pneumonia, according to the Philippines Health Department. Hong Kong reported its first death on Tuesday, a 39-year-old man who traveled from Wuhan. The World Health Organization, said the number of cases will keep growing as tests are pending on thousands of suspected cases. There's no vaccine to protect against the virus, although the National Institutes of Health in Maryland had confirmed that they were in the early stages of developing one. Symptoms of the virus include fever, cough, and shortness of breath. There aren't many preemptive steps that can be taken to avoid infection other than practicing basic sanitary measures on a regular basis, which, of course, is the answer to so many things, but we have fallen short so often. Well, U.S. authorities discovered the longest smuggling tunnel ever found along the southwest border. It originates in Tijuana, Mexico, near the Otay Mesa port, port of entry, and extends a total of 4,309 feet, more than three quarters of a mile. The next longest tunnel in U.S. history, discovered in San Diego in 2014, was 2,900 feet long. While subterranean tunnels are not a new occurrence along the California-Mexico border, the sophistication and length of this particular tunnel demonstrates the time-consuming efforts transnational criminal organizations will undertake to facilitate cross-border smuggling. In a press release, the acting special agent in charge of Homeland Security Investigations, San Diego, said the investigation that led to the discovery spanned many years and involved various agencies. A tunnel entry team agent stands by the for security at a tunnel to continue to monitor such activity. The tunnel features a complex cart and rail system, forced air ventilation, high voltage electric cables, panels, an elevator at the tunnel's entrance, and a complex drainage system, according to the U.S. Border Patrol. No arrests or seizures have been made at this point after the discovery of the tunnel. One only wonders how many others there may be. The investigation continues, and she says, the deputy chief patrol agent, I am confident that our hard work and dedication to uphold the law will lead to future arrests and seizures. The tunnel is around 5.5 feet tall, 2 feet wide, 4,300 feet long, averaging 70 feet deep, and had a ventilation system, electricity, rail system designed to move large packs of drugs. Well, due to the composition of the underground soil in the area, the tunnel is mostly self-sustaining. It's approximately 5.5 feet tall, as mentioned. As efforts to strengthen security on our southern border increase, Mexican drug cartels are forced underground to smuggle their deadly drugs into the country. DEA Special Agent in Charge John Cowley says the sophistication of this tunnel demonstrates the determination and monetary resources of the cartel. Two U.S. soldiers were killed and six more were wounded on Saturday when American and Afghan troops were fired on during a mission in a province in eastern Afghanistan. The casualties occurred when an Afghan wearing an army uniform suddenly opened fire. The U.S. military has not officially called the incident an insider attack because the motive remains unclear and the shooter was not one of the soldiers on patrol. Such attacks have been frequent occurrences and nearly two decades, U.S. troops have been deployed in the country. In 2012, for example, 25% of American military deaths in Afghanistan were caused by allied Afghan forces, according to military officials. On Saturday, military spokesman Colonel Sonny Leggett issued in a statement saying those involved in this most recent attack were engaged by direct firing. In addition to the Taliban, we are not ruling out ISIS being responsible for the attack, the defense official said. Where the attack took place is home of roughly 200 ISIS-affiliated bombers. And finally, Attorney General Bill Barr confirmed Monday that the Justice Department is reviewing information about Ukraine coming to the department from President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and others through an intake process to gauge its credibility. The Justice Department has the obligation to have an open door to anybody who wishes to provide us information that they think is relevant, Barr told reporters. But as I did say to Senator Lindsey Graham, we have to be very careful with respect to any information coming from Ukraine. Barr went on to explain that there are a lot of agendas in Ukraine and a lot of cross currents. We can't take anything we receive from Ukraine at face value. For that reason, we had established an intake process in the field so that any information coming from the country could be carefully scrutinized by the department to assess its credibility. And that includes information coming from the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani's, and others in that region. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Up next, we'll talk with Jean Holthaus. She's the author of Managing Worry and Anxiety. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, good afternoon and welcome back. You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show. Well, Christians deal with anxiety and worry just as much as anyone else, sadly, but many feel guilty about it because Scripture tells us quite clearly not to be anxious for anything. Well, what should Christians do when they do struggle with anxiety? Are they bad Christians for worrying? And how can they help others who are experiencing extreme anxiety? Well, in her new book, Managing Worry and Anxiety, my next guest writes about how we can manage these things and provides practical tools to help you deal with life's challenges. Jean Holthaus is a licensed therapist of 24 years and director of Two Pines Rest Clinics. She integrates both the psychological and spiritual aspects of anxiety through research-driven and faith-informed methods. In the book, she covers the difference between healthy and unhealthy anxiety and worry, factors that may indicate someone has an anxiety disorder, how to help a loved anyone with an anxiety disorder, and some key scales to help manage anxiety, and how one's views of God impacts the level of anxiety one experiences. She provides simple, practical strategies to tackle anxiety and worry, showing how to use the five senses to live in the present moment, and tactics to suspend judgment through guided questions. Well, Jean Holthaus has some more, as I mentioned, more than 25 years experience providing therapy. She currently works as a clinician and manages two clinics for Pine Rest Christian Mental Health Services. Her professional experience includes working with individuals, couples, families, and much more. She's a member of the National Association of Social Workers and the American Association of Christian Counselors. She lives in Pella, Iowa, and we are delighted to have her with us today to talk about her latest book, Managing Worry and Anxiety, Practical Tools to Help You Deal with Life's Challenges. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be able to be a part of this.
This is such a poignant subject for us today. Perhaps we should begin by defining worry and anxiety. Are we talking about a clinical anxiety, or are we talking about someone who just is agitated? Can you help us understand how you're using these terms?
Sure. And that's actually part of what makes this so hard, is that we use those words interchangeably.
Yes.
And it makes it hard to tell if we're, you know, having an anxious moment or someone that has an anxiety disorder. So I think about it in terms of, we all are created by God to have a healthy anxious response when there's something external to us that is a threat. So if a car veers into my lane of traffic, I'm going to have anxiety. And that anxiety is going to push my body into fight, flight, or freeze, which it needs to in order for me to react so that I steer away from that car rapidly or whatever the threat is. But it's healthy anxiety because it helps me deal with an external threat. And as soon as that threat passes, the anxiety begins to dissipate too. So that would be what we would call healthy anxiety. And that's not what Paul was talking about in Scripture when he says, be anxious for nothing. But then there's this next step over, which we would call worry more, and that's what Paul's talking about when he talks about anxiety. And it's where we're actually responding to something that's not actually present in the current moment. We're either thinking about things in the future that haven't happened yet, and we're doing all of the what-ifs about those things, or we're thinking about things in the past and doing the coulda, shoulda, oughta. And in those situations, we have no power to change those things. And there are places where we have to trust our past to God because he's taking care of that. And we need to trust our future to God because he says he'll provide for it. And then one step beyond that is what happens when people get a clinical diagnosis of an anxiety disorder, which is actually a chemical imbalance within the body, which is causing it to live in fight, flight, and freeze either all the time or intermittently when without us kind of knowing when it's going to happen. So there's kind of that continuum there.
Aside from this being displeasing to God, if we have crossed the line into what's healthy, what are the consequences to us as individuals when we experience anxiety that's unchecked, that's in the unhealthy range?
Sure. Actually, if you look at what happens for worry and what happens in an anxiety disorder, is your body is kind of stuck in that fight, flight, freeze space. Which means it's pumping out all sorts of adrenaline and other chemicals into your body all the time, which causes it to be under chronic stress. And it affects virtually every system in your body and causes it to begin to degrade and break down. So there's just this litany of physical problems that comes from living anxious or worried all of the time, or even a lot of the time. So it affects our physical body. It makes it really hard and steals our joy and our peace in the present moment, too. So it affects us psychologically as well. And it's really hard to have a relationship with God when we're kind of trying to play God and figure out all the answers without having to trust him. So it affects every aspect of our life when we're living in those places.
So when we acknowledge that we suffer from inordinate worry or anxiety, what's the first place we need to start? I suppose acknowledging the fact that this is a struggle, but where do we go from there?
Sure. And oftentimes it's hard to tell that difference between, am I living in that kind of worry zone where it's a bad habit, or do I have actually a physical condition? And so I always tell people, start with going and getting a physical, because we want to rule out physical things that could be wrong with your body that might be causing it to do that. And make sure that you're healthy in those ways first, and then start looking at, okay, I'm going to need some help to retrain my body and retrain my mind to do things differently. And I may be able to do that on my own. I may need the help of an accountability group of some sort. I might need a therapist to help me kind of sort through why am I doing what I'm doing, and are there other ways for me to live and build new habits? So it's kind of a process, and recognizing we have to learn to do it differently. We don't just wake up and kind of vow we're going to do it differently and have it work.
Now, we might think of worry and anxiety as being a biological response alone, but you have a chapter titled How We Think and What We Think Affect Anxiety. So a lot of what goes on in our mind has an impact that does have physical consequence, but has significant significance in terms of how we express this very unhealthy thing when it's reached that level. Can you talk a little bit about how we think and what we think, of how that affects anxiety?
Sure. So if we were to use an example of, like, let's say that I am going to go for a job interview, that should produce a little bit of anxiety for any of us, right? But if in my head I am worrying about all the things that I might say that are wrong and all of the ways I might make a fool of myself or all of the reasons this person might not like me, then I'm going to be running things in my head that are going to notch my anxiety up above that normal level that any of us would have into a place where it's going to be hard to think, and it's going to be hard to answer questions that an interviewer might have for me. And I'm also actually in a place where I'm not thinking well of myself, which makes it hard to put my best foot forward in that place. As an alternative, if I go to that interview and I think to myself, I'm going to give my best shot, and if they like me and God wants me to have this job, then we'll go forward, and if not, I'll keep looking. That's going to let me be a little calmer about that job, and it's going to let me answer questions differently than if I'm worrying about doing the right answer and keeping everybody happy is going to do. So how I think about it's going to affect the level of anxiety I have, and it's also going to affect what I do in the end.
You offer three skills. You write about how these skills have been proven to effectively help manage anxiety. What are these skills, and can they be useful to anyone who is struggling in this area?
They can be useful to anybody. That's part of the reason I chose those three to write about, is because whether or not you have normal levels of anxiety, you're kind of in that worry zone, or you have actually a clinical disorder, these skills will be helpful. And they're the skills of learning to live in the present moment, learning to live without judging yourself and others, and then learning to live believing that you and God are competent to handle what comes at you. And I call all three of those skills because that's exactly what they are. We don't come into the world knowing how to do any of those things. We have to learn them all, and we have to practice them over and over and get better at them over time. And so if we think about it that way, that we're having to learn to do those things, it's more helpful than just being mad at ourselves that we can't do them.
That's good. You use the story in Exodus about the Israelites to help give us a picture of how to effectively manage to develop these skills and use those skills in trying to manage our anxiety. Can you tell us a bit about that story, how it relates to us in the 21st century and can help us manage and relieve our anxiety?
Sure. It's actually one of the stories God has used over and over again in my life, because when the Israelites leave Egypt, they run out of food, and they legitimately are hungry. And basically God says, I'm going to give you what you need for the moment that you're in. You can only have enough manna for today. And if you try to get enough for tomorrow today, it's not going to work. It's going to rot. And it does. So every day they have to trust him that he's going to give them what they need for that day. And they can't use what he gave them for that day for the next day. It doesn't work. And that's where we get into a lot of trouble, is that we take what God's given us for today and we try to figure out how we could use that to solve problems that might happen tomorrow or 20 years from now. And then we always feel like we don't have what we're going to need then, because the manna that God gives us for today is for today, and it's for today's problems. It's not enough for what will happen tomorrow or the next day, but he will give us that tomorrow. And kind of they had to learn that over and over and over in the desert, walking with him for weeks and months and years, so that when they come back up to the Jordan River to cross over, they can trust that when they step into that river, he's going to give them what they need. And when they cross over into the Promised Land and they're going to have to drive out the giants that they know are there, he'll give them what they need. So he had to teach them that for them, for it took 40 years. for them to learn it enough to be able to trust that much. And that's kind of comforting to me because I've lived longer than 40 years and I still don't have it all down pat, but I'm a little better than I was.
Well, that is somewhat comforting to know that it's going to take a little time. God's not surprised by that and that he's going to continue to teach us. We need to take a quick break, but we'll continue our conversation. Again, we're talking this afternoon about the book, Managing Worry and Anxiety, Practical Tools to Help You Deal with Life's Challenges. Jean Holthaus is our guest. The book is published by Revell. We'll be back in just a few moments.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show, continuing my conversation with Jean Holthaus. She is the author of Managing Worry and Anxiety, Practical Tools to Help You Deal with Life's Challenges. One of the things that you write about in the book is living in the moment, and you suggest an activity that we can adopt to help us learn to be in the moment rather than projecting into the future and worrying about what may or may not happen, or looking back and fretting over what has already happened. What are some of the activities, or at least one, that we can adopt to help us learn to be in the moment?
One of the things you can do is to use your senses, because if you can't see it, hear it, feel it, touch it, or taste it in the present moment, those are the only things that are in the present moment, are the things that you can use your senses to observe. And a lot of what we're worrying about has no basis in the present moment. And so when we find our brain kind of off on one of those what ifs, we just come back to, wait a minute, what can I see right now? What can I hear right now? What can I physically feel right now? It helps us to come back to the moment and know that you're going to need to do that over and over again. Our minds are not very well trained. So, you know, you bring yourself back to the moment and you become aware, okay, I'm sitting in my chair. And then you find yourself off thinking about something in the future again. And you just got to be kind to yourself and just keep bringing yourself back. And as you do that over and over and you use your senses to kind of bring you back to the moment, gradually over time, that muscle of staying in the present moment strengthens, but it'll take time, and you can use your senses to help you be aware of when you're in the moment and when you're not.
Oh, that's so good. How does judgment feed into worry and anxiety? And can you give us an example?
Sure. We all probably know the scripture that says, don't judge lest ye be judged. And we tend to think about that as, you know, the big things where I'm condemning something or someone like that or something like that. But judgment is any time we take one of our opinions and we turn it into a fact, and we act as though it's a fact. And those things increase our distress. And they increase our distress because we're either putting ourselves above someone else or we're putting someone else above us. And because we walk through our days kind of constantly grading ourselves against other people or grading other people, we assume that other people are doing that with us as well, and it makes us more anxious as we go through our days. And God says basically he's the one that knows to judge, and he's the one that knows ultimate truth, and we're supposed to come to him for those answers. We're not supposed to be trying to figure it out ourselves. And when we can let go of that and just accept the moment we're in and figure out what to do that brings life in that moment, that's when we can let go of the judgment and we can live more fully in that moment. But it's really hard to let go of judgment, and we like to judge a lot because I always kind of want to know, like, where do I rank with everybody else, rather than knowing, wait a minute, I come before God as just me, and he's not judging me anymore because Jesus has already died for everything he would judge me for. So I come to him already accepted.
You write about unconditionally accepting reality, which, again, is something that we can do that keeps us in the present. What do you mean by that, unconditionally accepting reality?
Well, it kind of means letting go of the shoulds and the oughts and the coulds and looking at, okay, this is what's here. Whether or not I like it, it is what it is. So now how am I going to be effective rather than trying to decide it shouldn't be that way? So if I have just lost a job, I can't really do anything about getting another job until I can accept, okay, I have lost this job. As long as I'm in that place of judging, well, I shouldn't have lost this job, I should have done this, I should have done that, well, my boss should have. As long as we're doing that, we're not really accepting the reality. When I can say, okay, I am currently jobless, this is the reality, what do I want to do with that? Then I'm in that place of accepting it, and I'm ready to move forward, and I'm less anxious.
You have a chapter titled, Our View of God Affects Anxiety. Again, we often feel guilty if we are experiencing being anxious or worrying. But how does our view of God feed our understanding of our current situation that may produce anxiety or we may find rest in because of how we view him?
Mm-hmm. In the book, I use myself as an example because I grew up in a Christian home and was raised in the church. But yet my view of God, I discovered as an adult, was a little off because I always viewed him as someone who loved me, but it was kind of this love like, well, I have to love her, not that he actually liked me. And it was much more that he loved me because he had to, but he was up there kind of keeping track of all my mistakes. And somehow I could make enough mistakes that, you know, he was just going to kind of give up on me. And that view of God then makes one really, really anxious and really, really concerned about making sure you do all the do's that he writes in the Bible and don't do any of the don'ts because you don't want to make him mad, right? Versus if I, and as I learned over time, that's not how God thinks about us. God loves us exactly the way we are, and he likes us exactly the way we are. There's a verse in Colossians that when it's written in the Living Bible that was the original Living Bible, not the New Living Bible. It says that we stand before him right now with nothing that he could even chide us for. So he's not up there keeping a list of everything we do that's wrong. He's up there saying, we can do this. We can do it. Let's keep trying again. We'll get there. And we have when we have that sort of a view of God, then we can be much more relaxed and we can come to him rather than being afraid of him.
One of the things that can produce anxiety is being in a position where we have to make a decision. It can be an insignificant, small decision or a major decision, but that's often anxiety producing for a lot of people. Explain how doing what brings life helps us let go of that anxiety when we're in a position where we are forced essentially to make a decision.
Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of those decisions every day as adults where we have to decide. And oftentimes we're trying to figure out what is the exact right decision or what's the wrong decision. And in many ways, that's very much like where God said in the Garden of Eden, don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of what's right and wrong. Instead, eat from the tree of life. He gave us permission to eat from the tree of life. And when we look at a situation and we look at, okay, what is going to bring forth life here? It's going to bring forth life for me and others, both in the short term and in the long term. Then I can move in that direction. And I can trust that God's going to be with me in that. Instead of when I'm sitting and trying to contemplate exactly what's the right thing or what's the wrong thing, that's very hard to determine because we're not wired up for that. And we have to trust that God's bigger than we are, and he knows the decisions that we're going to make, and he's willing to work with us on those decisions and get us where we need to be. That there's not some decision we're going to make that he can't figure out how to help us through. So it doesn't mean we can go recklessly off doing whatever we want, because we are told that we're supposed to do those things which bring life, not the things that would bring death or that violate his word. And the things that violate his word really don't bring life ever. If you look at long term, they might bring life in the moment, but they don't do that long term. So if we just consistently are looking at, okay, I'm going to trust that God's big enough that he's going to get me through this if I don't do it just right, but I'm going to work consistently to seek him and to seek what will bring life, then we don't have to be afraid of the decision because we know that he's with us in it.
We're talking about the book Managing Worry and Anxiety, Practical Tools to Help You Deal with Life's Challenges, published by Revell. Throughout the book, you provide very practical activities for readers to undertake in order to tackle their anxiety. Now, why are these activities important to complete, and how does that help us long term in dealing with anxiety or the temptation toward responding with anxiety in the future?
Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to realize that we weren't born worrying. I've never seen a baby that worries, and we learned how to worry over time, and we learned it as a coping strategy because little kids believe that they're kind of the center of the world. Therefore, if they could predict all of the things that might go wrong, they can stop them from happening. And the example I use with my clients is that's a little bit like slamming your finger in the door just in case you hit it with a hammer later. But because we've learned to do that, we've learned to practice that worry skill, we're going to have to learn different skills to replace it. And it doesn't do much good to try it one day and, well, I didn't get it right, so I guess I can't. We more have to think about it as training ourselves, training our minds to do things differently, and it's going to take time, and you have to build on it slowly over time. So my attempt in the book was to break things down into small steps that you could try one step and then build onto it over time. And maybe you try one thing for a period of time, and then you come back to the book and you look at adding the next piece in, because you're going to need to train yourself to do this new set of skills to replace the old worry set that you already had.
And again, the subtitle of the book is Practical Tools to Help You Deal with Life's Challenges. The book is titled Managing Worry and Anxiety. Jean Holthaus, thank you so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for allowing me to. It's been great to be on your show.
Again, the book, Managing Worry and Anxiety, Practical Tools to Help You Deal with Life's Challenges, published by Revell. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll be back in a moment to wrap things up.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to the final segment of The Georgine Rice Show. By the way, tomorrow on the program, as promised, I'm going to have a full conversation with Terry Matson. Her latest book is titled Courageous, Being Daughters Rooted in Grace. What does that mean? How do we walk that out? We'll talk with Terry Matson about that when she joins me here tomorrow. Also on Wednesday, we'll talk with Dave Harvey. I Still Do, Growing Closer and Stronger Through Life's Defining Moments. Marriage can be a challenge. It's wonderful in many ways, but it also brings with it significant challenge and decisions that have to be made about the future moving forward. We'll talk with Dave Harvey about how to get to and stay at I Still Do. He'll join us on Wednesday. Dr. Robert Jeffress will be our guest on Thursday. His latest book is titled Courageous as well, but his subtitle, 10 Strategies for Thriving in a Hostile World. Dr. Jeffress will join us on Thursday, and then on Friday, we'll take a look at the lighter side of the news. Well, after 115 years, Portland's Concordia University is closing. The school traces its roots in Portland all the way back to 1905 as a Lutheran academy for local pastors and teachers. Well, Concordia University, which is located in Northeast Portland, is going to close its doors at the end of this year's spring term. That's according to the interim president, Tom Reese. The school traces, as I mentioned, the roots way back to the turn of the last century. Now its days are numbered. It will be closed after the graduation on the 25th of April. The acting president will officially make the announcement and did earlier today. We're going to be telling folks sadly and with deep sadness that at the end of the 2020 spring semester, which ends for us in April, that the university will cease operations as a university and begin a teach-out plan. I'm not sure what a teach-out plan is, but when asked what it meant, that all parts of the school would close, he said, yes. Close the university, yes, sir. Well, Concordia offers 15 undergraduate degrees, along with graduate programs in management and English. It also operates as a law school in Boise, and all of that will be ended. The acting president agreed it will be shocking news for many. Oh, my goodness, yes, he said when asked about that. Well, the school held its annual fundraising dinner at the new Hyatt Regency Hotel in Portland just days ago, bringing in over $355,000 in pledged contributions. The program heralded the school's program to work with Fabian Elementary School in Northeast Portland, known as the 3 to PhD Initiative, and pointed to several other efforts underway. Well, the event was headlined by Common, an acclaimed poet, educator, and writer who praised the school's efforts. There was no indication at that event that the school was days ahead of announcing its time was drawing to a close. Well, the Concordia University Foundation confirmed on Monday that all donors at last week's fundraising dinner, which raised, as I mentioned, $355,000 for the school, will be offered refunds. The Fabian School Building is property of the Portland Public School District, and the district said Monday that the elementary school is not closing and will continue regular operations. President Reese arrived in Portland just over a month ago in early January as Concordia's second interim president. He retired last year as the president of Concordia University in Minnesota, where he was credited with lowering tuition and increasing enrollment. He had hopes of turning around the Portland school as well. He's quoted as saying, "I did not come here to be the bearer of this news. I came here with the intent that we would find plans to turn the situation around. But to do that would have involved so much risk, it would have put the students in probably an even worse position than they are now." end quote. He said it would have involved trying to borrow even more money for a school that is in the red. Trying to borrow more money when we already don't have anybody that's going to lend us any more money, taking a shot at trying to increase enrollment when we have limited resources to do that, those kinds of things where you're already rolling the dice. And I think the board felt the odds were better to not do that and create even an even worse situation. Well, President Reese said Concordia had 8,000 students 4 years ago and only 5,000 now. According to the school's website, 98% of students get some sort of break on their tuition. Concordia in Portland is losing money. Yes, no question about that, he said. It's been negative cash flow for quite some time, and its assets and its liabilities are out of balance. Well, President Reese said that the primary lender is an agency of the Lutheran Church, and that while they have been very generous, they're no longer willing to loan Concordia money. He said raising tuition or cutting salaries or both is not an option. Been done, been tried. Cutting salaries, you know, the folks around here have been through that more than they should. Well, the president said Concordia will help students transfer to other schools for next year, and that faculty and staff will be told about their options in an upcoming, in the upcoming weeks. He didn't say what would become of the school's grounds and buildings. And so after 115 years, Concordia University's days in Portland are numbered quite literally. He agreed the decision and announcement feels like someone has died. Oh, for goodness sakes, absolutely. There is so much grieving, he said. An institution that has been a part of the Portland landscape for 115 years is simply no more. Again, Concordia University, that has been here in Portland for so many years, is going to be closing its doors after graduation on the 25th of April. And that means all operations there will be suspended. Kind of sad news. I have friends who are graduates of Concordia University. Well, the United States has been joined by 26 other countries in a new international religious freedom alliance, and they're seeking to reduce religious persecution all across the globe. Together, we say that freedom of religion or belief is not a Western ideal, but truly the bedrock of societies. That's a quote from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo at a dinner at the U.S. State Department launching the alliance that will involve senior representatives of each government represented. Again, 26 countries. The alliance's first meeting fell on the eve of the National Prayer Breakfast, which gathers international religious and diplomatic figures once a year, to an event chaired by a member of Congress and organized by the International Foundation, a Christian organization also known as the Family or the Fellowship. Well, Poland, one country in the alliance, announced in a joint statement with the State Department that the next ministerial to advance religious freedom will be held on the 14th and through the 16th of July in Warsaw. Building on the success of the 2018-2019 ministerials hosted by the United States, the 2020 ministerial will allow countries to share different approaches, debate varying perspectives in the spirit of coherence and complementarianism, and address challenges threatening the freedom of religion or belief, the statement from the alliance reads. Well, the two countries said participants at the Warsaw meeting will address promoting inclusive dialogue to mobilize action and increase awareness regarding the scale of persecution against religion or belief worldwide. Besides Poland and the United States, the other founding countries of the International Religious Freedom Alliance are Albania, Australia, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Brazil, Bulgaria, Colombia, Croatia, Czech Republic, Estonia, Gambia, Georgia, Greece, Hungary, Israel, Kosovo, Latvia, Lithuania, Malta, the Netherlands, Senegal, Slovenia, Togo, Ukraine, and the United Kingdom, and of course, the United States. The State Department issued a list of principles for the alliance that included a commitment to the right to hold any faith or belief or none at all, and the freedom to change faith. The new organization's priorities include challenging blasphemy laws and the denial of registration to non-religious and religious groups, and advocating for people who are imprisoned or otherwise persecuted due to their religion or their beliefs. I want to thank James Blend for producing today's program, Clark Hilton for engineering, and thank you for making the Georgene Rice Show part of your day. Once again, tomorrow we'll talk with Tara Matson, Courageous, Being Daughters Rooted in Grace. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRiceShow and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.